there a writing craft book on your bedside table? Has it been there for a while?
Do you keep meaning to get past chapter 2, or chapter 1, or just the first page?
Then the Words to Write By podcast is for you. Hi, I'm Renee. I teach composition and creative writing to college students. My background is in poetry, but I'm working on my memoir.
And I'm Kim. I'm trained as a science journalist, but now I'm trying my hand at short fiction. Each week, we'll be tackling a chapter of some well-known, but perhaps not so well-read, writing craft book.
Together, we'll uncover brilliant insights, face the hard truths, and totally disagree when the author is wrong.
This is our podcast, after all.
And then, we're going to take what we learn and apply it to our own writing.
By doing the book's suggested exercises.
We're inviting you to read along, or just tune in for the Cliff Notes version.
We're committed to improving our own craft, one writing advice book at a time, and we'd love for you to join us.
Hello! Just want to give a little shout out to somebody who tipped us in the tip jar for the sound equipment. Thank you very much. I would mention you by name, but I don't know if you want that to be anonymous. But anyway, thank you so, so much. We really appreciate it.
And you guys gave us a nice little shout out for saying that you enjoyed having us read the book for you.
Yeah, that was cool. That was really cool. That's the whole point. People like us, Kim. They really, really like us.
Well, thank you for joining into the episode. Today, we're going to start with interviews. Last episode, we discussed characters and how it was critical that your narrator or your protagonist be likable for the reader to keep reading. So I reached out to some authors to find out if they use this technique for their characters and how it works out for them.
My name's Patricia Schulteis. I began writing fiction late in my 50s. The book I'm going to talk about today is St. Bart's Way, my short story collection about a fictional street in Baltimore and the people who live there.
So you have multiple main characters. Are all your main characters likable, do you think?
Possibly likable. I think they're recognizable. That's more of what I go for. In other words, my character's likability is not first and foremost in my mind when I set out to write a story. I do hope my characters enable my readers to empathize with them and maybe even sympathize. But for the most part, my characters have all the human qualities and redeeming features that we all have. They're petty, they have crushing disappointments, jealousies, self-doubt. Some have overweening ambitions. They're capable of betrayals. Some of them are also very intelligent. They have wonderful curiosity. They sometimes are generous, capable of self-sacrifice. In other words, they're human. I kind of equate likable with humorous. And in St. Bart's Way, there are two stories where the situation is humorous and the character then becomes humorous. And one is a story about a man named Wilcox Miller, who goes to see a dying former neighbor from St. Bart's Way. And the neighbor says something that triggers in Wilcox's mind the idea that the neighbor had an affair with Wilcox's wife way back when. And that Wilcox is determined to get into the neighbor's house to see how they signaled each other. But the house is now owned by an Indian family. The whole situation transpires in the course of a day. It's funny and humorous. And Wilcox is somewhat of a Falstaffian character.
These are 5,000 word stories. And so you don't have much space. You're at an economy of words. What things do you put front and center when you're starting a story to make these characters realistic, to make us feel like they're real people and that people you'd empathize with?
How to show that character soon is a very, very tricky skill. A lot of it has to do with the perspective of the narrative voice. For instance, the story about Wilcox Miller, the voice is very arch. It's not a first-person narrative, but the narrator is very much a presence in the story. He uses very archaic language to almost make fun of Wilcox's presumption of his middle-class virtues. standards and expectations.
Have you ever written a character that is unsympathetic that people just want to like stop reading because they just don't like him or her?
I just submitted a story to my writing group. It's about Teddy Holbrook when he's really in the grips of alcoholism. And one of the commentators said, he's not a fully developed character. He's very flat. Well, I didn't want to hear that, but I guess I have to pay attention to it.
Do you think that he's considered flat because he's just unlikable? Or do you think that there's...
I think he's flat. He didn't have enough dimension to him. I mean, it's very hard. I think characters, even who do vicious things, that arises from something in their past that was maybe done to them horribly.
My name's Paul Lubashevsky. I write generally horror comedy, but also horror and fantasy. And my newest novel is Like a Ton of Bricks.
So you write horror. Do you think your protagonists are likable?
I would like to say it's a prerequisite, but I read a lot of really good, really dark stuff where the protagonists weren't. But generally, I find it to be a prerequisite for my own writing. I want the reader to be rooting for the right person.
I find that I only root for the bad guy in a horror film if I really don't like the protagonist.
That has happened. There's the famous Betty White line from Lake Placid. I'm rooting for the crocodile, and I hope it eats you and all your friends.
So how do you go about creating likable characters for your stories?
Well, I think the important part is to write people. And that includes like sense of humor. That's actually one of the biggest foibles of a lot of books is people are humorless. And that's not how people are. And it's especially not how they deal with crisis. Gallows humor is the grandest of all grand traditions. So when somebody like writes these characters that don't have a sense of humor, they don't feel real. They don't feel like people. They feel like characters.
Can you give an example of humor that you've given a character that's made them more likable?
Well, yeah, I think in all of my books, but I'll go with Brick, because if you went by the stereotype, he's the most inherently dislikable. He's a mob hitman, but he tends to, on his free time, whoop up on bullies and jerks and just the people we would always want to see that happen to. But he also has a sense of humor. And on top of that, just to screw with the stereotype, I made him a Camus reader.
A what reader?
Camus. Albert Camus. French existentialist writer.
Excellent.
It bounces nicely. At one point, another character demands, you speak French? Well, how else am I going to read Camus in the original language?
Anything else you want to add?
I think that's actually the most important part of building a likable character is look at people around you, look at them like act and react on their best and worst behavior, and write people. Don't write the humorless stereotype of it. Write it so the person's cracking jokes. They're real. They feel real. They feel like a real person. And then the reader's going to inherently want to root for them.
And thank you so much to the authors for taking their time to talk to us. Now we are going on to this week's episode. We're discussing two chapters in the book. We're discussing plot
and dialogue.
And these are hefty chapters, so we're just doing two.
Yeah, I mean, they're so hefty, we probably should have just done plot or dialogue, but they feed off each other.
I got less out of the plot one than maybe you did, but let's start with that one.
See, this is the most bullet pointy out of them. There's lots of stuff in here in plot,
but I think we have to first start off with the first paragraph, which says, if you are looking for a long, brilliant discussion of plot, E.M. Forster and John Gardner have written books which they discuss it so lucidly and wisely that they will leave you howling like a wolf.
Yeah, I noticed the John Gardner in there. I'm wondering, why did she drop their names in there?
Well, they're two very famous books. E.M. Forster has a very famous book, too, which I've tried to start reading and I couldn't do it all. But I'm curious about, do you ever read something that's so lucidly and wisely written that you end up howling like a wolf, Renee?
No.
It doesn't seem like behavior that one someone would have when, like, you have something that's written very lucidly and wisely.
Yeah, well, you know, howling like a wolf. If a person is howling like a wolf, yeah, I'm not sure why someone would even howl like a wolf for anything.
The next sentence is, I just want to add a few thoughts here, things that I pass on to my students when they seem especially bitter and confused.
So maybe this is a joke. Maybe she's bringing them up like, sure, I can't say anything bad about them because they're kind of famous, but they don't make any sense. And they are confusing.
And by this time, Gardner was dead. So you really could kind of say that.
Yeah.
I'm going to go with the fact that she also was frustrated with Gardner.
I agree. And apparently also E.M. Forster. Maybe we should read him.
I have a copy of that one.
Is it worth reading that whole thing for a podcast?
I can tell you I wouldn't be able to read it if it wasn't for a podcast.
Yikes. I don't know, man. I think we earned our chops with Gardner. I don't know if I want to do that all over again. We shall see. Anyway, so plot. There's a lot going on in this chapter. One thing that I noticed, it's very similar to the MFA program fiction style, is that plot grows out of character. So that's what she says. You know, your plot isn't developed outside of your character, and then you take the character and you make them fit it. It's the other way around, and this is what we call character-driven plots. But there are plot-driven novels, a lot of fantasy.
Genre fiction is plot-driven.
Yes.
I think we should address that at the end of this, but let's talk about just this concept of character-driven plot. And likewise, the corollary there is you can't just put your characters into a plot. You can't just insert them into a plot and make things happen.
Right.
Because it won't feel real.
Right. Which is funny because that's exactly what happened when I did write a novel. I wrote all the way through it. Halfway through, it took that long for me to give up on the forced plot I was putting them through. And then suddenly the story actually started sounding good. It never occurred to me because there's so many people that have to outline novels, right? They're like, you have to have this, an inciting incident. And Bickham was very formulaic.
Right. Let's start first talking about more the MFA literary approach. If you were to explain this to your grandmother about it, why would they care? So for somebody that didn't major in English, some tech person you know or whatever, how would you explain this whole concept of character interactions creating the plot?
Well, the whole thing is centered around a character or a set of characters. It's mostly about that character's feelings and how they're reacting to the world. In a character-driven book, it revolves around the character. The voice is very strong. The feelings are there on the page. It's all filtered through a character, and the character is kind of what makes things move along, not so much the things that are happening to them outside of them. Those things do happen, but it is focused on the character and the decisions that those characters make. That is what a character-driven plot is, at least in my brain. That's how I would describe it.
And given how she's been presenting writing up until this point, you know, you mine your subconscious, you create these characters with their own emotional anchor, you breathe life into them, and you let them go and see what happens. It makes sense to have a character-driven plot. They're the people in charge, they're what is happening.
Yeah.
Like, for something like memoir, I think this probably is very aligned, because, you know, people are people, and a story came out of the way they interacted with stuff. Sometimes you have memoirs where some major thing happened and people are coping with that thing. But even there, it's one action and then it's their reaction to it and how they change over time after that.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think it was Philip Lopate who said this. He said, you know, memoirists, they have to turn themselves into characters. You are a character on a page. You are only sharing parts of yourself. But it does revolve around you because that's a memoir. It has to revolve around a character. So the point being, according to her, characters should not conversely serve as pawns for some plot you've dreamed up. But I don't know. I mean, don't I sit around fantasizing about the cool plot I've created and that's a mistake I've made?
I mean, here's the point. Most of us overall have kind of boring lives. If we don't have some plot coming in and affecting us, like, not much happens to us.
Yeah.
Like, I've read parts of your memoir, Renee, and there are periods of time in your life where there's a lot of plot happening to you. And that's where the story came from. And your current life and your current situations wouldn't make for the same page-turning memoir.
No. I have 3 cats now, and my husband. I play Witcher 3 and I watch the Great British Baking Show.
And you have friends over for drinking parties.
I definitely have friends over for drinking parties. And then I come over to my friend's house and we record podcasts. I find my life very fun and interesting, but there's not enough trouble to make it interesting in a book. This is why I have to mine my childhood.
Right. So she says, drama is the way of holding the reader's attention. If you're going to have the characters drive the plot, then they have to have drama.
Right.
Like, there are a lot of movies out there where you just take some very radical characters, very different characters, you smush them together, and a plot emerges from that because there's so much drama. So I see that method. However, I don't think it works for all stories.
I think some people have to plan a few things. How about this? Just think of Steinbeck's, I think it's Grapes of Wrath. Is that the one where they go out west?
Yeah, the migrants.
Okay. So one could see this on a plot level. One could say, I want to write a story about migrants going west to find a better life.
Part of that story, I haven't read it, my husband's read it. Point is that the characters will make a particular set of ideas, the things they're going to go and do, and then something really bad happens, and they're not prepared for it. So the fact that continually bad things keep happening to them, things that are outside their control that are driving them, that's plot.
Right, but... at some point, that's just a scenario. That's just the background flavor. Yeah, there's these people and they're going out west in the Dust Bowl and they're failing, essentially, right? Which makes it depressing. But the things that are in there are how they're reacting to those things and how they're reacting with each other. It is a story about the Dust Bowl, but it's also a story about a family. But what is it more? Is it more a story about the Dust Bowl, or is it about a family?
I mean, Steinbeck wrote about people. It's always about the people.
So he's writing character-driven.
Right. But I think that you can take Lamont's advice and say, well, you know, I have these fascinating characters. I'll just keep putting them in conversations with you to have them do stuff, and that will be enough. But there's not actually a plot to keep the drama going. This is kind of advice that I say, yes, it really sounds good. And I read it and I get excited. I think, yes, a story that just has the way that characters bounce off each other and how they evolve and all that stuff. And I love those sorts of stories. And yet, I think it's not easy to write this kind of story well. And so many people out there write genre fiction. Mysteries, science fiction, fantasy, romance, and thriller. The whole Bickham scene and structure is based on having a plot-driven novel.
So much so that the very last chapter was a plot, just bullet-pointed, of this happens, then this happens, then this happens.
With things like, and the character realizes this stuff thing about him, or the character fails to do this one thing, and then, you know, the sub-character does this other thing, and there's not even what their specific goals are. Their own personal narrative is just generalized into, you know, a character has heartbreak, or a character does this thing for this other person, gets them in trouble. There's nothing there.
Right. So would you say then that Bickham's novels are suffering from the warning that she gave, which is that characters should not conversely serve as pawns? So those characters are pawns.
Those characters are pawns.
Okay. But that's like almost derogatory, right? If we're trying to say that genre fiction is valid forms of art and can be just as good as character driven.
And people love the characters in genre fiction. People love the Harry Potter series, and yet there are some pretty serious plotting going on in those books.
Totally. Totally. But the characters are so alive in them.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess if you are going to write genre fiction, there's going to be big plot driven stuff, but it's still the good stuff. The ones that really rise to the top, I think, are character-driven.
So your experience writing your novel, you said basically you got halfway through before you finally abandoned the plot, or you let the characters do their own thing.
Yeah. And then it actually started getting good. And actually plot got better. Things got better.
When I was plotting my fantasy, I looked at a bunch of other fantasies and I recognized that at least at the 40% to 50% mark of the novel, we had to be going into a lot of action, a lot of fighting, a lot of running, just lots and lots of action. So I plotted the story to have a lot of action, but I really didn't know what that action was going to be until I got there and wrote the first draft. And then I went back and realized that there were other things I want to do. And I'm rewriting that. I know that there's got to be action in certain points. I know that the actions have to result in certain things, like Bickham's outline of, like, you know, the failures that the characters make and how things get worse along the way. But I'm also letting the characters' personalities determine what those things are.
That's character-driven.
Yeah.
At least partly, definitely.
Mm-hmm.
So a character that's, again, like the previous episode we talked about, you know, flat characters versus round characters and having emotional acres, right? If your character doesn't have an emotional acre, they're probably a pawn because they're just reacting to things that are going on outside of them instead of having rich emotional landscape.
Yeah. A lot of the other chapters before I felt were like dead on, had like just really a lot to mine from. This one feels a lot more nebulous. Like either you get it or you don't get it. But if you're a person that hasn't quite figured out how to have your characters drive the plot and you have a very rigid plot, I'm not sure how you can use this chapter to figure out how to do it. Because this feels like she's telling you, let the characters do their own thing and have a plot emerge. And a lot of people don't start a novel that way.
Well, I wouldn't say a lot of people. I think a lot of people do start novels that way. They start with a character and then they see what their character will do. I mean, I don't know if a lot of genre fiction writers write like that, but that is the default of what I learned to do, at least in school. I don't know. In college, that was always you start with a character and then you have a plot, which is actually what she did. She says start with a character. And then she does have a formula in here. I mean, you're not going to get a bullet point, do this, do this, do this. But she does say a lot of things like, for example, drama is the way of holding readers' attention. The basic formula for drama is setup, build up, and payoff. That's essentially a character arc or a three-act structure. I mean, she does say have a three-act structure. She doesn't say that out loud, but that's what that means. The payoff answers the question. What is it they're trying to give? Drama must move forward and upward. Bickham said the same thing, although he gave us a formula for making it move forward. She's not giving you the answer on how to do these things. She just tells you that this is what they have to do, and she's making you trust that the character will find its way there, I suppose.
I mean, maybe the reason why I'm not quite grokking with this is that I think about how I come up with a story, and I almost always come up with some plot idea. And then I figure out the characters that have to go in there to make that plot idea work. Like, we were talking to our friend Chris recently, and he came up with a really fun AI story. And he was kind of describing what the overall plot of it was. And I'm like, that sounds really good. I said, you know what it needs is this type of character here. And I won't give anything away because, you know, he might have it published or whatever. But I don't want anyone to steal his really awesome idea. But my mind likes to take the plot points and then decide what kind of characters would work the best to make those plot lines work and feel real and be impactful. So maybe my issue is I don't start with the character. I almost always start with the plot, and then I figure out who would work in that plot.
So that's kind of the opposite of what she's doing here.
Yeah.
Would you consider your characters pawns?
Oh, totally pawns.
Oh, well, shoot.
No, I don't. Or rather, maybe this is part of my scientist brain, but I think of a plot as an experiment, and then I think about the variables that have to go in to make that plot fully realized. And along the way, the characters become more and more real, and they do exert their own personality on how things play out. But my first framework is plot and then the right characters, and then I move from there. And I do like her whole emotional acre, which I'll just like write who this character is, and more stuff will show up, and then I'll find out what the relationship with the other characters are, and things like that will build, and how they react in the situation. All that stuff gets worked out, and I work out a fair amount of it before I start writing. But it does start with plot for me.
But then in your revision, do you go back and till the soil of that character a bit more so that it's more character-driven, like it did become like halfway through their book?
Yeah, I think that when I'm actually writing down the words, it does end up being very character-driven. But it's not this idea of you take a bunch of interesting characters and you see what grows out of it.
Interesting. Well, again, I still find some formula in this chapter. Just a little bit, right? She does mention that three-act structure. She talks about three types of climax,
for the climax, there must be a killing or a healing or a domination. And these can be metaphorical, obviously. It can be real or whatever. The ending of your book, if you're willing to not reveal necessarily what happens, but what type is it? Is the ending of your book a killing, a healing, or a domination? Would you see it that way?
So the climax of the book is kind of a killing and a healing. Like, and then there's the whole resolution part too. So the question is, what's climax and what's resolution? Definitely the resolution is healing.
True. Yeah. She says, if someone isn't changed, then what is the point of the story? Does anybody change at the end of your story?
Oh, yes.
Oh, good. Okay, well, she has some other good nuggets in here. She talks about that your story has to have the sense of inevitability. Like, it needs to just feel right.
Well, that was Bickham's, too, the whole business about it. It had to be surprising, but then it had to make perfect sense after you've gotten to the end of it. His basic comment is that, you know, you just keep working at it, and eventually it'll become easier and easier each time.
Yeah. And I actually really like this. She does provide somebody else's formula for writing a plot, which I thought was really cool. She took this from a woman named Alice Adams, and she said that sometimes she uses a formula when writing a short story, which goes A, B, D, C, E. A is for action, B for background, then development, climax, and ending. So you can write a story with those guidelines.
That's a dangerous acronym because I could very much see myself forgetting most of it and then coming back and saying, well, it's got to be A, B, C, D, E, right? So action, background, and okay, then climax, but then I need to get to the development in after that. I wouldn't remember that she switched the letters.
You've really absorbed Bickham, haven't you, Kim?
No, I just know that I'm a really bad speller. And like, if I knew the acronym had an A, B, C, D, and E in it, that's the order I would treat it when I was working from it. If you make sure that you take the D before the C, it's a good order of stuff. It's a framework to start working on stuff.
Yeah, it's a framework. But if you read this chapter on plot by Anne Lamott, it makes suggestions but doesn't tell you what to do. It's a very middle-class way of teaching.
Now, the next chapter, dialogue, I loved. Probably because I like writing dialogue. I like looking and saying, I did this, and I do this, and I do this, and oh, look, I'm so clever. I do this thing she tells too. I'm like golden.
That's cute. That was fun, dear listener. You didn't get to see that, but man, I saw Kim just light up. It was great. I thought it was interesting that she mentions purple prose, and we had an activity on that like a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away on book one, John Gardner. Remember that? We wrote in purple prose.
Mm-hmm.
She calls that bad dialogue.
I love that she gives a really good method for determining how your dialogue is, which is you read it aloud.
I agree. I read my stuff aloud all the time. I'm constantly trying to tune my ear to what's going on in my prose, but I think that's the poet in me. Do you do that? Do you just sit there and just read your dialogue as if it's like a conversation to see if your characters sound real?
Yeah, and also if they're playing off each other correctly. The other one she says is, you're not reproducing actual speech. You're translating the sound and rhythm of what the characters say into words. I want to first preface with the idea that often you'll read someone's dialogue that just isn't very good, and they'll say, yeah, but I want it to sound natural. I want it to sound like people really talking. And the problem is that nobody wants to listen to people really talking.
Right. It's kind of like when you're watching a movie, you don't see the characters using the bathroom. Yeah, it would be more natural that you would see them doing mundane things like that. But you only have an hour and a half to tell that story or 2 hours to tell the story. You're not going to waste it unless it's Pulp Fiction. And then John Travolta, anything big that happens in that movie, he's on the toilet. Even his own death. Spoiler.
You remember the Ramona Quimby version of it, don't you?
The what?
Ramona Quimby. When Ramona Quimby goes to the kindergarten and they're all sitting around, all the children are sitting around listening to the story, and Ramona realizes that here in kindergarten you can ask the big questions. She asks something that she's always wondered after the teacher gets done reading the book. She says, when did Mike Mulligan go to the bathroom?
I have no idea what you just said, Kim. Who?
Beverly Clearing. Those books?
Beverly Clearly.
The Ramona? Oh, the Ramona books.
Nope.
You know what Mike Mulligan is, right? The Mike Mulligan and the steam shovel?
No.
Okay.
Nope, didn't read them.
So yeah, it's the question, when did Mike Mulligan go to the bathroom? And all these kindergartners like, when did he go to the bathroom?
So this is for kindergartners, the story?
Mike Mulligan's for, yeah, grade schoolers. I mean, it's for little kids.
Is it new? Like, did you read it when you were a kid?
Oh, yeah.
Oh.
And I read it to my kids.
Maybe it's like a Midwest thing, or maybe.
It might be, but I think it was East Coast when it was written. But
oh,
anyway,
well, maybe
East Coast. I'll show you. Anyway.
We have different.
It's dropouts, isn't it? Different dropouts.
Dropouts?
Things that we don't realize we don't know that everybody else feels
yeah.
you yeah. should know.
Well, I think it's cool on the podcast.
Okay, anyway. But back to, we don't say when the characters go to the bathroom. We cut out so many things that characters do. And sometimes we cut them out in like kind of summary sorts of ways. So we cover that they're actually doing it. And sometimes we just like say, you know, whatever the people are going to read and they're going to keep going. And I think that what makes for good dialogue is the right rhythm and word choices and the way it plays off what the other person is saying. Because I really feel like there is a rhythm to dialogue.
Yeah, and I think each character kind of has their own. Because we all have different kind of cadence when we speak. Mm-hmm. She does say something about movies. She does say that dialogue is more like a movie than it is like real life, since it should be more dramatic. And that reminded me a bit of Bickham, where he's like, fiction is not real life. It has to kind of make sense when life doesn't make sense. And this is the same thing. Yeah, in a movie, you cut out all that stuff. Maybe the real person would use the bathroom and make breakfast and all that stuff, but you're not going to waste screen time on it.
Or when the detective is revealing what really happened the night of the murder, you don't have people interrupting and say, wait, can go back. You said this person here or no, I misspoke. And this was this person. Like if people were actually describing it, there'd be a lot of back and forth and people not quite getting it. But the detective gives it all in one beautiful montage of images with their voiceover. So I think that's what you're aiming for in your stories, in your dialogue. And likewise, I've often rewritten dialogue because I realized it started to go off track a little bit. Like mm-hmm. it's starting to meander. And what I wanted is to be nice and crisp. Like, this is kind of an interesting bit, but it's too talky. I'm just going to trash that. Sometimes I'll have like this or that, and I'll switch to this or the that. So that way it carries on with the lines of dialogue that I want it to follow.
That's a good strategy.
I think that I found a really good exercise in her stuff. She has this idea of take someone's 5-minute speech and make it into one sentence. So I think when we get to the exercise portion, I've got a proposal of what to do with this.
That sounds fun. Yeah, okay. I would like that. So she's got the two methods, right? She's got the one method, which is to sound out your words, to read it out loud, get the cadence of the character. But then she says to identify each character by what he or she says. So there's the content, the kinds of things they're saying. And I thought that was really cool because in my prose poetry, a lot of it dealt with dialogue. Somebody would say something and that would kick off the poem, or I would analyze what somebody said. Like there was this one poem, I don't think I ever published it, but I had overheard a conversation. It was a woman and a man. And the man said, well, that's just how women are. That's just how they treat me. And I heard that and I was like, oh, there's a poem there. And it ended up being about their relationship. I made up a lot of stuff, but I wanted to investigate who ends up in a relationship like this. How does somebody tolerate that crap? A lot of my poems do that. They either start with dialogue or they analyze the weird shit people say.
I think it's actually fun to keep a tiny little notebook on you. And then when you ever overhear a piece of dialogue that's really good, you just write it down. I did that for periods of time and I had some really good zingers.
People say weird shit. Mm-hmm. You know, that's another thing. That's something she didn't put in here, probably because it's action and not dialogue. But one of my favorite tactics when I write is to describe people by what they do. So maybe I'll list one or two details of things that they have done that colors their character. Like only a weirdo would do this. Well, this character is a weirdo. So I'm going to make them do things. It's not in a scene. It's just a quick like description. Oh, and this comes from the guy who blah, blah. You know.
One other thing she suggests is putting two characters that don't get along together and trapping them into an elevator and listening to what they have to say to each other.
There's a lot of movies like that.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of stories where basically you got to set up for how to get these two characters, and maybe they fall in love with each other or not, but two characters that you know is going to get some drama if you put them together and force them to be together.
Isn't that the entire reality TV franchise?
Right. Yeah.
You trap them in a scenario in which they would normally never be. Like, what's the one, the first one, which was they were all in a house together.
Yeah, the MTV one.
The MTV, what was, oh God, I can't even remember. Anyway, they're all in a house together, and they clearly picked them because they all have very different, strong personalities so that they would fight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they were encouraged to fight, and then they were edited. Conversation isn't natural. It's, you know, edited and properly put together that to make it really click and pop.
The real world.
The real world.
Which is complete, it was not the real world. It was the manufactured world.
Yeah. One reason I love doing the interviews at the beginning of the podcast, I love editing them down to just have them pop and just have like, because people ramble a little bit, but I pull it all together. I always make sure the meaning is still there. But it's amazing how a little bit of editing and moving stuff around just makes the things flow so nicely.
I love your interviews. I love listening to our interviews. I'm just delighted. I'm as delighted as the listeners, honestly, because I don't really hear them until, you know, you send me the draft. And I'm like, oh my God, that was amazing. I'm totally using that strategy. Or I don't know. There's great personalities. And yeah, you do really, you're really good at editing. I mean, you make me sound good.
Part of the trick is you have to have stuff to work with to begin with, but yes.
Which is exactly what Anne Lamott's saying. You know, we don't sit there and plan our chats in detail at all. We just sit here and talk about the book and then you edit it. That's the same as her drafting. She drafts stuff to get it on the page and then she edits later, right?
Yeah. Yeah, she looks for the good stuff and pulls that out, crushes everything else. Fortunately, just so you know, we do not have four-hour conversations, and I edit them down. They're actually much tighter than that.
Yeah, Kim gives us a deadline on time, and that forces us to pick and choose.
The other one, I was going to go back to the two people in the elevator idea, was that good dialogue encompasses both what is said and what is not said.
Subtext.
I think that is really important. You can leave certain things out in a conversation and they could be just as meaningful to the person reading it. Like they pick up on that too, and that's part of what drives attention and drives the interactions is the stuff that doesn't get said.
Yeah. I think Hemingway, was he the one who said it was like an iceberg? Dialogue is like an iceberg. You only see the top, which is what people say, but there's so much going on below. Or maybe he was just talking about subtext in general in a story. Didn't we do an episode on that?
I think we did something about icebergs, yeah.
Yeah, we did in one of our show notes. I'll have to go mine that for...
But yeah, that's something else to think about when you're writing dialogues, that you don't have to have every single thing be said. Sometimes things don't get said, and that's something for later on to explore further on.
Yeah. This is interesting. Lamott says something that, to me, goes against the big piece of advice that should be said everywhere, and it does get said everywhere, and she goes against it, and I'm wondering what's going on here. So she says, you want to avoid at all costs drawing your characters on those that already exist in other works of fiction. You must learn about people from people, not from what you read. Your reading should confirm what you've observed in the world. She's telling people not to read?
She's telling people not to have a favorite character and then repeat that character in another setting. Like she's saying that by going out in the world, observing people, interacting with people, getting feels for real complex people is going to strengthen your ability as a writer far more than reading a book where somebody has laid out the character and shown you what parts of their emotional acre they need for the story. You've got a very edited and compacted character in books, whereas in real life, people are messy with a whole bunch of stuff. The thing about dialogue being not the same as what people just talk to each other. Let's take it to what she was talking about before, how when people converse, you don't just want to use the conversations as your dialogue. It's got to be more than that because you're going to cut out the stuff that is interesting. You're going to play off of things. You're going to get the rhythm, the cadence. You're going to have something truer to what they're actually saying. However, if you're only to read dialogue in books and you didn't actually hear how real people talk to each other, then you'd be missing all the stuff that goes in to putting out that perfect dialogue. It's like if you go to a restaurant and you eat a cake, that's delicious. You can't just go home and say, I'm going to make that cake. I'll look in the cupboard and grab the stuff that I think that I tasted in that cake and put it together.
Yes, you can.
But if you didn't know that you needed flour, but like, honestly, you know how to make a cake. You've made how many cakes? You know how to go to a restaurant and say, ooh, I really like this particular flavor or whatever. I'm going to incorporate that into my cake. But if you were someone that never did any baking and went into the kitchen and said, I'm going to make that cake I just tasted.
So this advice that Lamotte's giving us is only for beginning writers?
Yeah, I think so. Because honestly, once a person gets to be a certain level of writing, they do it however the hell they want. And people say it's great.
Right. Like, I got to be a better baker by reading recipes and viewing them over and over and over again. And a lot of them have been the same cake over and over again. If I go to a restaurant and I try a cake and I really like it, I can go home. I'm not saying I would succeed, but I will go home and I will rely on my technical knowledge of baking and my history of baking to recreate the cake.
And it's people that are learning to write or want to move their writing to the next level that pick up a book like this and follow the advice in the book. And they really do have to probably go out in the world and actually observe people as opposed to just writing from the characters that they've read in stories.
So this makes me think of age. It makes me think of the difference between a young writer or someone who's young who wants to write and someone who's older, right? If you see a lot of contests online for an emerging writer, a lot of times the age on it is like anyone below 40. And you're like, wait, they called that a young or, you know, a debut novel under 30, you know, and you're like, 30? How is that young? But it comes down to experience. A lot of stories that teenagers write and poems especially that they write are really just bad, but it's from lack of experience. The world is still black and white for them, and you're not going to get as much nuance out of it.
And you know, when you're a kid, people don't treat you to show you quite that much nuance either. Sometimes it involves being in a workplace situation and being thrown with a whole bunch of other people, or having a brand new college roommate. All those things that happen to you as you get older, like, you just get more exposure to real life the older you get. Just as a matter of course, and also once you be a certain age, just get treated differently. With any luck, a 12-year-old doesn't get exposed to a whole bunch of really horrible stuff.
Hopefully not. Well, that's from which memoirs are made.
Right.
But, I mean, I would say, you know, if someone's in their early 20s or whatever, it might be hard to write a good, believable story because there hasn't been as much observation of the real world yet. Or you don't see people that you're not completely used to interacting in the wild.
And also, one of the best things to help you write a good book is having written a crappy book beforehand and learned a whole bunch.
That's true. So yes, dear young writer, write a whole bunch.
I mean, it's kind of crazy how many times I interview somebody and they say, you know, I wrote 4 books before I got one published.
Those people give me hope for myself.
The fact that they wrote those 4 books in 3.5 years, maybe that not so much, but.
Right. Now that's a tall order. I very much respect that.
Anything else from this dialogue chapter that you felt was really useful for you or that you really liked?
Well, I have some things that I've highlighted, which clearly I think were important. So I liked when she said, the only thing to do when the sense of dread and low self-esteem tells you that you are not up to this is to wear it down by getting a little work done every day. And that made me think of your interview in the last episode of that one woman who said she wrote every day, 365 days a year. I love that. That was great. And I sometimes wonder, because I do the opposite. My brain does the opposite of what I know is correct, which is what Lamotte is saying, is you can't know. You can't know or plan your way into a good book. But my brain wants to desperately. And that's why I have 50 craft books on my shelf. But the advice goes against that. It's like, no, you got to sit there and you have to write every day. And so I highlighted that because I need to write every day.
I think one of the reasons why people love this book is that all the way through, no matter what she's talking about, it keeps coming back to the fact that, you know, writing's no fun, but you got to do it anyway. And probably half of what we as writers really need to hear is that whole business of, yes, just sit back in the chair and keep writing.
Yeah.
just keep writing. Then the other thing, it's more not knowing, this more faith thing. She doesn't say the word God or anything, but more and more, I guess maybe with Bradbury and reading this, I'm starting to get more and more of this, like, you know, you have to have faith in things that you can't control, which is really hard for me to do. And she said, and she mentions the unconscious. She goes, all of it happens in a part of you to which you have no access, thus unconscious. You know, the unconscious is going to come up and it's going to help you, but you can't force it. It's like this magical place. The muse lives there, right? And Bradbury had his advice where you can feed the muse on reading and then it will be more readily available, but you can't control it. And I'm always trying to control it.
This is a really difficult concept for new writers, especially because there's so much that goes into writing. And you know when you've written something that's not good and you want to either try to logic it out to write it better, or you want to pretend it's not bad and keep going. But you need to acknowledge that it's not good. But I think what happens is the more you write, the more your brain can fix this stuff without, like, you really having to, like, go super analytical or, like, reach out for a bunch of resources. That you're training your brain as you're writing. But I think one of the issues that beginning writers have is that their brains aren't trained to do this stuff yet. With my most recent novel, my only novel, you know, my first draft had a whole bunch of places where I just wrote something that had to go there. And I trusted by the time I got around to it that I'd figure it out. And actually, I know I told, I'd say I plot everything ahead of time, but like the whole, what was really going on and how things were interacting and how they were going to beat the bad, that stuff I actually didn't know when I wrote the first draft. I had something in my mind, but then when I was going back and writing the second draft, it all fell into place. So even though I haven't gotten to that section of the book, like, I know what needs to go there now. And it just sort of worked its way out, the subconscious. But I'm not sure if that necessarily happens for the first-time writer.
I think it's all subconscious for the first-time writer. I think a lot of people come to writing not by reading craft books. They'll read, but then they just sit there and they write. It's the beginner's mind. And that's something I always wish I could go back to.
I don't know. My beginner mind stuff, I look at it and say, oh, I was reading, you know, all these kid lit books here, and that's why my protagonist did this and that and the other thing, because that was, those were the plots that I saw, and that's what I was working off of.
I wonder if it's different because I was writing poetry. Poetry, yes, you can get very analytical about it. When I was young, I would read, but I wouldn't, like, tear it apart. I would use it as a springboard to inspire me to sit there and just let my brain go and do things.
Yeah, and I was never a kid that wrote poetry.
I'm wondering if it was the genre that makes a difference, because I invested most of my time in poetry, not so much story writing, although I loved reading stories and mostly wrote really, really bad poetry on the bus. That was Renee's pastime, but I had to ride the bus a lot.
Okay, so I think we should go on to our exercise, but first, let's talk about this process group that we have going every other Wednesday.
Yeah, so we have a process group coming up on Meetup. You can access it by going to our website, and there's a little poster there, and you just click on it, and it will take you to sign up on Meetup. It is free, and it's really fun.
Yeah, we cap it at 20 people, but the last time we didn't have 20 people show up. So if you can't sign up for that one, sign up for the next one. And, you know, 2 weeks from now, you could try it there. But it was really neat. We had a lot of interesting people with interesting writing things. And I think everybody gained a lot from listening.
Yeah, we give them a suggestion. Like, hey, if you can't think of anything to talk about, you could talk about this. Mm-hmm. But they already have questions. People show up with questions or concerns. They talk themselves into the answers they need to hear sometimes. And we all get to sit back and watch. And it's great.
And one person just said, well, you know, I just want to listen this time. And that was good, too.
Yeah, it was cool. I bet you we're going to see her again.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so exercise. Here's my thought. Lamont had the whole idea of listening to like 5 minutes of someone talking and then condensing it down. And there are a whole bunch of YouTubers out there that talk. And so my thought is, let's find either one where there's two people talking together or one person doing a monologue and listen to about 5 minutes and then condense that dialogue down. Turn it into dialogue. Cut
cut some bits and pieces out, and we'll do that for our writing exercise.
Okay, we're back from our exercise. We haven't done exercises for a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like we were lazy, but we had a lot going on.
Yeah, and some writing craft books are very much in your face. If you do this exercise, you will improve. And Anne Lamont's a little bit like, you know,
just show up every day, move the pen.
And I also noticed that her description of what she suggested was to distill a 5,000 word piece down to one sentence. And we didn't do that. We actually went through and just kind of tried to pull the dialogue out of a longer conversation.
So that's what we did. I have the shorter version, so I get to go first.
Right. So kind of a setup for what this is. This is a recording from a delightful podcast called Afternoon of Delight, featuring three romance writers who talk about Korean dramas and K-pop culture and all Korean cultural pop culture stuff. I had heard this little story that they said at the beginning, not related at all to what they usually talk about, but just the experience that one of them, Megan, had when she tried to tackle a mountain that was too hard for her.
Dude, that was hilarious. So Kim sends me this recording and I just start listening. It's like kind of like Very Bad Things, the movie, but not
in real life.
Without murder. Yeah, it was crazy. It was really awesome. So yeah, if whether you listen to this activity or not of what we've done to this transcript of a podcast episode, definitely check it out. You'll have a really good laugh.
And I want to include right now here a little recording so you get an idea of what her voice sounds like and just a bit of the flair of it.
Okay, listen. No one told me that there's like 150 people have died on this mountain. No one told me that.
Yep.
It's the highest peak in the Northeast United States. It's like over 6,000 feet, 6,288 to be exact. And do I know that? Yes, I'm going to tattoo it on my forehead.
Tell me a little bit about your approach. Since this is a very vague kind of exercise, and we didn't tell each other how we were going to do it, tell me a little bit about what you did before you read your piece.
Okay, so you sent me the transcript. I listened to it. I had a good laugh, and then got the transcript. And I first went to town on the editing. I went through and I was like, all right, what are the details that have to be there? That's the core of the story. So details about the plot, essentially. Who are the characters? How did they get there? The setting. So I took out anything that didn't have that involved. I also kept anything that sounded what I felt like was her. So this is all dealing with voice. You know, it's the things people say, you know, like the word like, depending on where it's placed in the sentence, if it's common enough in speech that adds to the character. So I was just very concerned with making sure I had the voice down and I didn't remove her voice. I did add things. I cut things from the plot because I really wanted to say, like, how short can I make this? But also keep Megan. Have it be Megan, but put it in prose, maybe for a novel or a monologue or something that was highly edited. And so that was my approach. Did lots of bolding. I bolded main things and then I cut out the other things and then I just kind of put it together. I also edited it twice. So I have a longer version. And then I said, I bet I can make this shorter. Came it down to 600 words from how long was this?
A bit more than 3,000 words.
Yeah. So I reduced 3,000 words down to 600 words.
Okay, let's hear it.
All right. So the I in here, of course, is Megan, the podcaster. So just imagine that she is telling the story. So I went on a camping road trip with my husband and our two kids, along with my best friend, Annie, her husband, and their two kids. While we were planning the trip, Andy had said she wanted to do a hike up Summit Mount Washington. Of course, not knowing anything about Mount Washington, I agreed. Apparently, it's the most dangerous hike in the U.S. 150 people have died on this mountain. But do I know that we're climbing the highest peak in the Northeast United States? 6,000 feet. 6,288 feet, to be exact. With kids? No. I'm just thinking, sure, I'm prepared. We're just going for a fun hike up a mountain. Once we set up camp and started hiking, it wasn't long before I realized this was a really bad idea. We were surrounded by boulders the size of a cow to a fucking Volkswagen. We hadn't even arrived at the first summit yet, and my legs couldn't reach down from the rocks.
Professional hiker types just fly past me. As for the kids, they're like mountain goats. I'm like, where are the cutbacks? Where's the dirt path up this mountain? The guy from the lodge had said that the first hour is the worst. Then it evens out. Maybe that's why I kept going. Eventually, I found myself facing a wall of rock. To my left, a sheer drop off a waterfall. Everyone was way ahead of me when I finally reached them. And then I find my daughter clinging to a rock, crying. I took her hand and we slid side by side along the little path, trying not to plummet to our deaths. At one point, I thought we were about to make it to the top, but we weren't even close. I kept thinking, just go a little further, but it was just more rock trail steeper than a staircase. At some point, Sean announced we reached past the point of no return. We can't go back, he said, even if we wanted to. The only way was up. And that's when I collapsed to the ground and the world starts spinning. I wanted to throw up. I laid my head down and blacked out for a minute. At this point, it occurred to me, either I would reach the top or I'd be airlifted by chopper. Just then, I look up and see we're at the last rock. It's rock field and rock town. No grass, no path, just 4.6 vertical miles up. And it's still the last one. So I keep going. When the summit finally comes into view, I see the people milling about in the visitor center. I get excited because it looks like I'm about to make it after all when I get this sudden urge to poop, like shit my pants poop. I look around for somewhere to go, but there's no trees. So I found a rock to shit behind. But just as I'm about to pull down my pants, I look up and the people at the top have full view of me out in the open.
I love that part.
They'd witness the whole thing. Neil says, we only have 100 yards to go and this hell will be over. Bedraggled and full of poop, I made it to the top with the kids cheering me on. So yeah, I almost died, but I got the I climbed Mount Washington sticker and the t-shirt. Now I'm like, I can do anything. And I also finally got to poop. And you know, it was the best poop ever. That was a pretty good story.
I know. I love it. You can tell this person writes books. When you listen to the recording, she's just kind of furling it. It's not like she's planned it, but you can tell the details she puts in and the asides that her mind thinks that way.
She did a really good job. Like I tell, oh, there's a beginning, middle, and end to this story. And there's these dramatic beats that happen throughout. Mm-hmm. I noticed all of those. And unfortunately, I had to cut a few of those dramatic beats and I had to like kind of twist the story and it removed them to get it as low as I did the word count. But she's a good storyteller.
Mm-hmm. And for the record, when she was having to go further, it was 0.6 miles, not 4.6 miles.
Whoops.
That was from the transcript, though, because it was an automatic transcript. Oh. And so it transcribed it as 4.6. And what she said was it was 4.6 miles. It was 4.6 miles.
Whoops.
Other than that, sound pretty accurate.
Did you feel like anything was missing since you know the whole story?
So we all listened to the bonus podcast. I did it a little bit differently. Well, for one thing, I kept it as a script form with the commentary by the other people as she's telling the story. But you made it all one long monologue.
Yeah. So if we took Anne Lamott's suggestion where you listen in on conversations and then you reduce it down to like one sentence or two or whatever, I could see how you could take a monologue like this and then slip it into a story where somebody's like, well, you asked me about this one thing, and I just got to tell you the story of what happened to me.
She's got a lot of good lines in here, too, and I liked how you worked them in. I think you described how you went about doing it. Was there anything you cut on the second version that was in the first version that just had to go to make it shorter?
Yeah, like little details, some dialogue. Let me see if I can find. So a lot of it would be what Jack Bickham calls the sequel. I really squished the sequel down because there are a lot of elements to this story and her commentary is great, but that would rob it of also the dramatic beats. So since I sacrificed a lot of dramatic beats, I ended up having to sacrifice a lot of the sequels. Mm-hmm. And in the longer version, there's a nice description that I kind of wish I could have kept, but again, I was really trying to go down. This is my little bit longer version. And here she says, we make it to the top, but guess what? We didn't really reach the top, just more rock trail after rock trail. We're not even close to the summit. I think, let's just go a little further. And I mean, I keep climbing up rocks steeper than a staircase. Then Sean says, we've reached the point, no return. I think,
when did we pass that? Now I know I'm in trouble. So like, it sounds good, but it's like, oh, I got to reduce it down.
Mm-hmm. And like, you completely cut the idea that the way this trail works, that the summit actually has a road on the other side. So tourists are driving up there. And
right.
There's tour buses and there's people out there. And so it's not like she comes to this pristine summit or where there's just other hikers. Like, there's people there.
Yeah, but she, at the top was a bathroom.
Yes.
And so at least there was that.
Yes.
At least there was that. There's some other fun things that really would color this character. Here's another one. It has some more dialogue that other characters actually get to speak that I cut. I'm about to say to Neil to leave me, save yourself. But just then I look up and I can see the summit, people with their stuff, the structure at the top. I think I can totally do this. But right then my body starts to shut down and I suddenly have to poop, like shit my pants poop. And I tell Neil, but he says to wait because there's a bathroom at the top in the visitor center. No, I say, you don't get it. I have to go. You know, like, I think I like the longer version I wrote a little better, but for the sake of the activity, I was trying to reduce it down. Now, if I took all this and reduced it down to a sentence, I don't know if we want to do that, but I feel like the main idea here is I almost died, but I at least got to poop. Or it would be called the best poop ever. Yeah. I don't know you, Megan, but I'm sorry. Whatever. I hope you find this very funny.
I climbed the tallest peak in northeastern United States to have the best bathroom break ever.
She'll never forget that poop. She'll never forget it. I'm sure we all have one of those. Oh, Lordy.
Do you think you learned anything from this exercise?
Yeah. Yeah, I think I did. I like the idea of people watching. When I was younger, I did a lot more people watching. I did a lot more like journaling where I would be at a cafe and I would be listening to people and I write down things they say. I don't do that much often now. Most of the things that like I'm getting influence from isn't necessarily the people around me, even though it's a memoir and it's from my memories, but it's dialogue that's in it, something in writing. I'm reading and then that's how I'm learning dialogue, but I may be missing a few things because I'm not always drawing from real life. And it's kind of like a give and take. I mean, we're always editing mm-hmm. real life. Even if it's fiction, you're editing the, you know, something natural about how language works. And the transcript was interesting because reading it was so weird. It's interesting how, like just right now, how I'm stopping and then starting and then stopping and then starting. There's a lot of that, but.
Oh, yeah, there's a lot. I get rid of a lot of that in editing. Our original audio is not nearly as smooth as the final product.
Actually, Kim, you sound like an expert at this. Now that I think about it, you probably did a really good job on this.
Well, we'll talk about it in the bonus podcast, but yes, I had a different approach than you, and it came out differently. But in the actual transcript, she interrupts herself. There's a lot of okays, likes. I go, you know, and then just doubling back. And when I did the transcript, I used an automatic transcription program. And I listened through to make sure there weren't any mistakes in it, because sometimes I get mistakes, although they've gotten really good these days. But I did not add any commas or periods to let you know what the pacing of her speech was. So when you're reading it in transcript, there's just like a whole bunch of extra words that are thrown into it.
Yeah.
But that's the way people speak.
Yeah.
So I think the first step in learning how to listen to people speak is just cutting out all that extra stuff, but deciding when to keep that like, when to keep that okay, when to keep those extra words, because it really delivers the dialogue better.
Totally agree. It just adds to the voice. It's not just the words they use. It's the order that they use. It's how often they use them.
Mm-hmm.
It's the patterns. I don't know. Do you think I did an okay job capturing her voice? Does it still sound like Megan?
It does, but it sounds like a bit more contemplative Megan, a bit more. In the moment when she was telling the story, she was back there on the climb, and you just could hear this emotion. And there, it's a little bit more like, you know, this is a horrible thing that happened to me, but this is me thinking about it. And it fits with the way you just designed it, too. Like the version on the podcast, she's relating the story to her friends who have never heard it before. She's telling it exactly the way she was experiencing it in the moment. Yours is a bit more collective approach, but there's still the intent behind it. There's still her voice.
Yeah. I think the 1,000-word one I wrote has her voice more in it. Like I read a couple pieces in it. I know there's more of her in there, but for the sake of science,
I think this sort of exercise is really good because if you're just reading in books, two things. First of all, you're reading an already edited form, so you're getting what somebody else's take on dialogue is. And the other thing is you are reading it, so you're only hearing it in your own head, or you're reading on the page and not even listening to the words in your head. When you read, do you have the words that you're reading in your head playing in your head like a soundtrack, or are you just reading the words and just processing directly?
Both. Like, if I stop to pay attention, I will hear it. But, you know, most of the time I'm just reading.
Yeah.
But it goes back and forth. It just depends on how much I'm paying attention to what I'm doing.
I think if you don't listen to people speaking in the real world and really listen to the way they phrase things, you're training your ears. And then when you're writing stuff, you're hearing it in your ears and you're getting that voice all the way along.
There was a trick that we used to do in my poetry workshops in grad school. And, you know, because it's poetry and it's shorter, we would have somebody else read the poem. So sometimes you'd pull out your poem to read it, to like get it workshopped, but you wouldn't read it. You could even request, hey, I want to hear the voice in this, see if it's got carried. So you ask the person next to you, hey, I'd always ask men just because, like, you know, I don't know. It's my voice is female voice. Just want to see how it sounds like in a dude's voice. So I would ask a guy, be like, hey, could you read my poem? And then they'll read it. Mm-hmm. And then at least it helps me remove myself.
Then you just hear the words themselves and not the...
Right. Mm-hmm. And then the same goes for fiction workshops. I know some will read a paragraph or two of their book. They'll have somebody else read it just so that person can hear what it sounds like because they're trapped in their own head. And it also helps to see if the punctuation and stuff has carried over the cadence of the language and the voice that they were trying to go for.
We're getting more used to audiobooks too. So, and it's probably a little bit back and forth. If someone's used to listening to their writing being read, then it's going to cause you to write differently because you hear what sounds good when someone else reads it.
Yeah, and that's actually a big part of my process. I wonder if Anne Lamott talks about this because we haven't actually read anything that has talked about it yet. I guess maybe just because I was focused on poetry for so long, you know, it's got an oral tradition, right? You go to poetry readings and you read out loud. And I'm always reading my stuff out loud, like all the time, hearing myself, like, does it sound right? Does it sound right? Like, I slow it down, I speed it up. If something's not right, I will read it a million times. Like, I'm always hearing what it is. And then I tell my students, like, so here's a trick, probably delete this, I don't know. But here's a trick on grammar, okay? It's actually a trick on punctuation. But if you don't know grammar very well, they're a writer, that is okay, right? You read a lot, you'll soak up most of it, but there might be some more errors, like pesky little errors that are just yours. And one trick I learned before I had a metacognitive understanding of grammar was inflection. So if you go back through your piece and you read it to fix the grammar, you read it as if you're reading a fairy tale. You'll notice that your voice will go up and it will go down when it hits punctuation. And that's how punctuation helps pull us through. I learned a lot of these techniques when I was writing prose poetry, because in prose poetry, you don't have the line breaks helping you. There's no line breaks, right? The line breaks can't help you pull you through the piece. So you have to use like the internal structure of the sentence to do that. Anyway, so for example, instead of saying, well, after a prepositional phrase that might be running into the main clause of the sentence, you might want to use a comma so it doesn't cause any confusion. You could just say, once upon a time, there was a little girl who lived in the woods. Notice how my voice went up and it went down. That's where the comma goes. You're welcome, comma splice queens. You're welcome. I just fixed your error. And so I would tell my students, read it like they're reading to their little brother or little sister, like it was a fairy tale. And then you'll, you know, inflect a lot more to add emphasis. And suddenly all these errors pop out at you. Suddenly you're like, oh, I'm supposed to put a comma there. Oh, that's definitely a period. Right? Like that's, you know, it and also it helps figure out like what's the cadence of this character. What, how do they speak?
Yeah. Yeah. I think training yourself to this is a mix of analytical training where you're really drilling down and saying, okay, like like, what is the structure of the sentence? What is the dialogue? And then a more organic feel where you just listen to it enough that your brain fills it in.
Yeah. And I would argue most writers are the second one. I don't think most writers have like this very crazy understanding of the English language and grammar with punctuation and crap. That's what editors are for.
Well, what I was meaning more is like when you're writing it out to basically analyze your sentences. Like when I was going through this, I was conscientious saying, okay, am I keeping this like? Am I losing this like? How many likes have I used so much? Okay, so I'm gonna go and get rid of this one over here so I can really have the emphasis. I can have her use the word like in this sentence here and it won't be.
Well, this is a question. Did you imagine this person, Megan, talking? Like, did you see her chatting?
I had her voice.
No, her voice. A mental image of this person.
I did, although I also saw a photograph of her, so that might have influenced it. But
see, I've never seen a photograph, but the whole time I was writing this, I imagined that she was where we are now. We're sitting here in chairs, and there's microphones, and she's trying to tell her story to her friend. And that whole time, when I'm putting in a like, I saw her emphasize something the way she was speaking. The character I created in my head of her, she would emphasize something, and that's when I would be like, oh, this is where she would say like. So that's how I was choosing those.
Oh, okay.
But I move around a lot when I talk, as you can tell. My hands are always like flying about. But nobody can see that, of course.
All right. Well, I think this is a really good exercise. It was a fun one to do. I'm glad we found a good story.
Well, you found a really good story. I was, man, it took me like, I don't know, 45 seconds. And I was like, oh my God, where did she find this gem? This is amazing.
I think I was procrastinating too. I didn't want to go digging through a bunch of YouTube videos to try to find something. Because when you're looking for something like this, you never find it. And then I suddenly remembered this one. Like, wait a second. That was a dialogue that I liked.
Yeah, this is a really good dialogue. Anyway, whoever you are, Megan, and what was her partner's name?
Amy. And there's also, I think, a Kia. Kayla?
Okay. Yeah. Well, anyway, thank you for that wonderful activity. I really enjoyed your story.
Yeah. Okay. So that's it for our podcast this week. Remember to check out our process group if you want to talk through some of the stuff that you're working through as a writer. It's a meetup group that meets every other Wednesday at 5 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And you can just sign up through Meetup.
Yep. Either type it in through Meetup and find us. It's called Words to Write By's Process Group. Or you can just go to our website at wordstowritebypodcast.com. And on the front page, you'll find a poster on there. And it has all the dates listed. And you just click on the picture and it'll take you to Meetup and you can sign up there.
All right. And then, like I said, the second version of this podcast is going to be on our Patreon site for our members. They have access to all the bonus podcasts where we go through various workshops, more detail, more nitpicky.
Yeah, more notes, more stuff and things.
Yeah. Okay. You guys take care and we'll be back in 2 weeks.
Cheers.
Words to Write By is produced by Renee Nelson and Kim Smiga Adam. Our theme music is Roll Back the Carpet by Cool Cat Music. Have a great day.
No, I wouldn't say that. Edit that out. Don't use that. People would destroy me with that one.